But Richard, why don't you get us started?
Okay, great. Thank you, Jennifer and Scott, Jason, David, others who are joining. Thank you very much. I thought today that I would discuss what I call four major types of equality. And the reason I want to do this is sometimes these types are seen as simply cumulative or additive. And I want to argue that they actually clash, and that the one true type of equality in the list I'm going to give you is under assault because there's such widening belief in the others. So first of all, not to be too opaque about this, let me just name the four, and then I'll discuss them. Physiological equality. That's number one. Number two, equality before the law. The number three, equality of opportunity. And number four, equality of results, sometimes called equality of outcome, more recently, equity. And I'll specify, obviously, I'll elaborate on these. The Declaration famously says that all men are created equal, but everyone knows that, of course, that does not mean the founders believed stupidly that we're all clones of each other. But it is interesting that the objectivist view and the Enlightenment view is that we do all share a faculty of reason. So there's some equality there you could point to. I'm not sure I would call it physiological, although we have a brain and a mind and a body as well. So I would grant that aspect of equality, but it's a faculty, and as we know, it's a faculty that you have to exercise by choice. So there, lots of differences can come into play because people don't always use the faculty or use it correctly, which means logically. So physiologically, that is easy, pretty quickly easy to dismiss. I mean, other than identical twins, nobody claims that the equality sought is of the kind of Twilight Zone type where everybody looks the same and truly are clones. Although you'd be surprised, some people in more twisted aspects of social engineering go that route, maybe in eugenics. But let's dismiss that for a moment and focus on the three most important: equality before the law, equality of opportunity, and equality of result. I'm going to contend that the second two, equality of opportunity and of result, especially pushed to its logical consistency, violates equality before the law, necessarily has to violate equality before the law, that equality before the law is the only legitimate conception of equality we can go with. So we do have to chew on that. But I also want to provocatively suggest that the current concern with and ubiquitous nature of cronyism results from this. Cronyism, as we'll say, reflecting differential treatment, literally favoritism, is really emanating from differential treatment before the law, which means it's emanating from an erosion of the principle of equality before the law. Then the question is, why is this principle being eroded? After all, it's one of the equality concepts, and if everyone's big on equality these days, why aren't they big on equality before the law? Okay, so let's start with that. Equality before the law, just in the vernacular, would be something like everyone's treated the same regardless of who they are, based on whether they've committed a crime, or it could be a civil offense. Let's put crime and civil offenses together. But the idea being, this is Lady Justice, we all know, has a blindfold on. Why is she blindfolded? Not because she's to be blind to the facts of the case. Not that she's to be blind to the law as written. You know, for example, rape is wrong, murder is wrong, robbery is wrong, that kind of thing. No, what she's to be blind to is who is standing in front of her. The equality before the law argument is the idea that regardless of whether you're tall or short, of different skin color, of different genitalia, of different ethnicity, of different age, of different political affiliation, we could go on and on and on, those distinctions are to be irrelevant. Irrelevant, equality before law, meaning everyone is treated the same, regardless of those technically non-essentials, not essential to the potential lawbreaker. Now, I don't have time here to go into subsidiary issues like, wouldn't the equality before the law require just law, proper law, legitimate law, however you want to put it? And the answer there is yes. So, for example, what if it was Jim Crow law? Jim Crow law, we know, is the Southern law post-Civil War, where the South, having lost the war, fought to preserve segregation in its laws and, you know, in all sorts of cases, schools and buses and public facilities and things like that, right? Well, that itself, when you think about it, is a discriminatory law. Technically, it's not a law. I mean, if we're talking about legitimate law, law is precisely law that does not discriminate in these non-essential ways. They do discriminate between the murderer and the non-murderer, but not between the white and black murderers, for example. So let's just stipulate that what we're talking about is legitimate laws, and that's a whole different discussion, of course, as to what laws are legitimate or not. The equality before the law principle also has this very famous idea that the rule of not law, not the rule of men. And what is that supposed to suggest? Well, that true lady justice is being blind. Your position and your own identity on the bench or in the juror's box is not to bias your judgment. Again, the judgment is the law versus the claimed act and whether it's legal or not. So the rule of law as opposed to the rule of men is another way, I think, of capturing the idea of the rule of objectivity versus the rule of subjectivity. Or the rule of certainty, say, versus capriciousness. Now, equality of opportunity, which is on everyone's lips, has been for years, seems to be related to equality before the law. But, of course, it's a separate formulation, so it's worth examining why it is. This is more the view that people should be equal, put it this way, in their starting point, in their birth status, if you will. And the argument and the complaint, of course, is that people are not born all in the same condition. They're born in different countries, in different socioeconomic classes, with different aptitude, with parents of varying responsibility and themselves intelligence and job prospects and things like that. And this is just what they're born into, day one, not anything yet that happens after that. And why do they focus on that? Precisely because it's argued the birthed person had no choice. The old adage, you didn't pick your parents. And now you could say your parents picked you if there was Planned Parenthood. But that's the claim. The claim is the birthed person is not coming into the world equal. And therefore, there's a problem. There's a problem, as it's said sometimes metaphorically. Some people are born on third base and some people are born on first base. And some people, I guess, are stuck in the dugout forever. Now, why is that metaphor used? Well, there are rules of the game in baseball, right? So the pretension seems to be, here's the critique, the pretension seems to be that there's an equality of law out there. They'll call balls and strikes. Everyone's going by the same rules. But it's never going to be the case that everybody has the same aptitudes and capacities when born. So that is seen as a complaint, as somehow an argument against going strictly by equality before the law. But now, this set aside for a moment the issue of what's done after the birth. The more the person grows, the more they have free will, the more they can choose their path. Presumably, we believe in free will. The determinists would not believe this. But if, to the extent we believe in free will, we say, well, even in cases where the birth status is going to be different, it is different. There's no identical circumstance. Not even within families, by the way. If you get five kids or so born to the same parents. They're all coming at different times, maybe different locations as the family moves around. So you can never have like perfectly controlled experiments even there. But the idea is, well, what if someone's born into great circumstances and then they blow it? They're born into rich families with high IQ parents who give them good morals, but, you know, by their own choice, they make, as they say, bad life choices. They hang with the wrong kids, they do drugs, they don't study, they drop out. Many, many cases of this. The fact, well, I wouldn't know if it's many, but the fact that there are any cases of this shows that there's no guarantee that being born into a great circumstance sets you on your way ineluctably. And likewise, the rags to riches stories tell us that people born into what are considered lower circumstances can achieve great things. But what explains that? It's an argument against the idea that equality of opportunity is all that relevant. Now, when you get to, let me just say before I go to equality of result, when you get to remedies, I just mentioned a remedy for equality before the law facing something like a Jim Crow law. Well, the remedy would be get rid of such laws because they violate the basic principle. But already in equality of opportunity, we see if that is to be quote unquote remedied, fixed, ameliorated, you would have to start redistributing whatever the birth positions are. You would have to, for example, say in some family, well, you're really advanced. The parents have an IQ. Maybe if we can't tell a lower income and a lower socioeconomic family to read to their kids at night, maybe we could at least ban the reading to kids at night by upper income people. See the kind of invasion that would have to occur from without to quote unquote cure this inequality of opportunity can get quite nasty. Now, even if you just use redistribution through the welfare state, all the things purportedly relevant to changing these circumstances, like, early preschool things and various housing things, and various food stamps and things like that. What is the purpose? The purpose is to equalize more the starting point that we see. Well, that necessarily is going to impinge on the rights of those whose resources are taken for such programs. And so you're already violating equality before the law because you're creating two classes, one class disadvantaged, one class supposedly advantaged, a two-citizen structure, right? The equality of the law is already out the window. Already Lady Justice is peeking through the mask and saying, oh, I see that you're wealthy and credentialed and you don't have the same rights as these people who are not. We need to redistribute. Now, equality of result. This one is more obvious to people that this is troubling, more so, I think, than the equality of opportunity argument. And it strictly says the results, not the starting point, but the ending point has to be equal. And now the issue here is, well, the same issue I had before, how to achieve that. You would have to differentially treat people to get to that equality. So on the premise that in a free society with free will, precisely because people are born differently and that they're not responsible to others for the position they're born into, they're neither to be credited with or charged with that, people will have different aptitudes. They'll have different work ethics. They'll choose different paths. They'll decide on different career choices or what kind of education to pursue. And of course, if we only look at wealth and income, which people seem to be obsessed about, people choose different careers, are going to end up with different income and wealth. And it's not due to any kind of injustice in the system. But even if you turn to things less focused on, like what about prizes? What about prestige? More so, say, in the arts and sciences. What about those who get more Academy Awards than somebody else? Is that unfair at the end of the day? Why aren't Academy Awards more evenly distributed? The key here, though, is if there is going to be this expected difference in outcome, perfectly natural, perfectly due to free choice, if you try to reverse that, if you try to quote-unquote correct it, you would necessarily have to, in policy, in legal rulings, in regulation, in taxation, in subsidies, in almost every government-type policy you can think of, you would have to start treating people differentially. You would have, or groups, sometimes it's grouped this way, you would have to begin to discriminate in order to affect a more equal outcome. So this gets back to my original point that these types of equalities aren't just additive. They're not just cumulative, as if you could say something like, well, in the 18th century, we believed in equality before the law, and that's perfectly fine. But then in the 19th century, we realized there should also be equality of opportunity, and that's good, and I got more equality coming in. And then, you know, in the 20th century, we realized there should be equality of result, and that's just a different flavor of the ice cream. We got more ice cream, more choice here. No, I'm saying that is not what's happening. They're clashing. The equality of opportunity and equality of result are clashing with equality before the law. Now, let me just give some quick examples so it's not too abstract here, and just some concrete examples that might make clear what I'm getting at. Just take something as simple as tax rates. If everyone paid the same flat tax rate on their income, say 10%, you could argue that that is equality before the law. Now, this is the tax law, of course, not criminal law or civil law. But you could argue that that's equal treatment. Now, it does mean, however, that the millionaire will end up paying more dollars taxes than the one who makes $10,000 a year. So the end result, you could say, is unequal in terms of the money contributed. But again, you could make the argument that if government's role is to preserve, protect, and defend individual rights and private property, that's key, and certain property owners have more property than others, the government's going to be more involved in protecting that. It isn't far-fetched to say possibly they should pay more dollar amount in taxes. But they would do that again with just a 10% flat tax rate. Now, what we have today in most systems is a graduated tax rate, as we know. It's called progressive. It's that stair step up where the more you make, the higher the rate. So the highest rate in the 1950s was 90%. So every dollar you earned in that tax bracket, the government would take 90 cents of it and you kept only 10%. The Reagan people brought that down to 28%, but even then the graduation was 10, 15%, 28%. Some people paid zero, of course. So that is unequal treatment. That is, in my estimation, unjust, improper, as it relates at least to the tax rate, the tax code here. So that's an example. And why is it treating people different? It's literally classifying them as you're wealthy and rich, I'm going to treat you differently. Not just treat, I'm literally going to take more of your income or wealth than I would for somebody else simply because there's a differential in the income. Antitrust would be another example. It falls, say, under the regulatory. Big companies, big profitable, successful companies, ones that win competitions are targeted by trust busters. Sometimes they're preempted. Sometimes they're prevented from merging with other companies and becoming bigger. Not because they violate anyone else's rights, but because they happen to have earned more customers. That is clearly unequal treatment. Now, Ayn Rand and others, Alan Greenspan, have shown that it's also arbitrary treatment, but I would say that flows from the idea that it's unequal treatment. It's unequal, and therefore anything goes, really, and therefore it becomes capricious. So the other type of citizen, so to speak, in that setting is the loser. The laggard, the competitor who doesn't win the competition, but gets this favorable treatment from antitrust. Sometimes they get gifts of patents transferred over from the winners to the losers. In finance, too big to fail. Too big to fail. People learned what that was in 2008, 2009. The policy had actually been in place since 1984. But that's an obvious one. To single out certain banks as big and therefore worthy of taxpayer bailout when there's a financial crisis. Now, there's all sorts of arguments for this. They don't want contagion effects. They don't want bank runs or blah, 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 blah. But the point is, notice the treatment. The treatment is, if you're a bad bank making bad loans, you can do it if you're big. And we won't do anything to you. We won't put you in bankruptcy or anything. We might even protect you from closing. We'll give you taxpayer money. But if you run your bank in a conservative, proper manner and never become insolvent, you might have to pay taxes to fund these bailouts. That is clearly unequal treatment. And it couldn't be clearer to say the big ones get treated one way, the little ones get treated a different way. More recently, in the COVID lockdown policy, Well, we all remember essential companies and non-essential companies, essential workers and non-essential workers. Now, to the worker and the proprietor, they'd say, this job is very essential to me. And I realize essential planners may not think so, but this income is essential to me. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. This business I started is very essential to me. But that very hubristic, a dualist approach to classifying those who essential, therefore, either wouldn't be locked down or wouldn't be so restricted versus non-essential, and they would be restricted and they would be extra taxes. That was just outlandishly a violation of equality before the law. I'll just tick off others without analyzing too deeply. Affirmative action to single out certain people in quotas and say they get in the front of the line, clearly unequal treatment. I would say the minimum wage laws, where they mandate a minimum floor below which wage rates cannot go, bifurcates the labor market into those would-be employers and would-be employees who fall above or below the line, a clear bifurcation and unequal treatment. I would say in the enforcement, not just the laws, but in the enforcement of the laws, there can be unequal procedural enforcement. The most recent case, I would say, last couple of years would be, well, if you're a trucker in Canada and you want to oppose the lockdowns and drive to Ottawa, you really have no rights. But if you're BLM and Antifa and you want to run rampage through the cities of America and burning and looting and torching, not only will you not be arrested, if you're temporarily detained, you'll face no cash bail. Why? So certain groups are favored, certain groups are privileged. It's the same activity, you could argue, if you want to argue that looting and pillaging is the same thing as driving your truck and disrupting traffic in Ottawa. It really isn't. But notice the differential treatment, the radically different treatment of how you conduct yourself in protest in public. Last one I would name, well, there are obvious ones like slavery, but everyone knows that. It's unequal treatment of human beings based on their skin color, or the idea women can't vote and men can vote. That's obviously discrimination. There's differences between civil and commercial speech. Long ago, the Supreme Court said political civil speech is protected. That's left free, can't be censored. But we know they gave up on that in terms of commercial. Well, they can tell commercial advertisers, they can regulate them very specifically. So there's another breach of the equality of treatment principle. In the remaining 5 minutes I've given to myself, I just want to do a couple things. Quote from the current Vice President, Harris, and Biden himself, the first week they took office, I don't know if anyone recalls this, had press conferences stressing that everything the administration did would have as its guiding principle equity. This third category, this third very deadly category that runs at odds with equality before the law. And not just equity in the idea of equal results. It was the principle, now think of this, this comes up as somewhat of a technical term, disparate results or disparate outcomes. The argument is if you just look out at the world and see disparate outcomes, it is, on this theory, ipso facto evidence of unjust, unequal treatment. So, for example, if you look out, this is how they think of it. If you look out in the world and you say 50% of the population is women, but only 50% of women occupy CEO jobs. So the argument would be the CEO market is biased and because of its inequality. In other words, it doesn't conform in this crude way to the actual population percentage of fill in the blank. Now, sometimes I'll tease colleagues or students and say, well, does that mean the NBA is racist because 90% of the players are black, but only 12% of the country is black? Of course, they would not say that, but then we would have to say, well, no, it's because they're more capable. They're more skillful. And I said, yes, exactly. So why are you looking at race? Why aren't we looking at merit? Why aren't we looking at talent? But this look for this, because this idea of disparate impact or disparate attempt, they like to jump to the idea that since I can find an unequal outcome
it must have been due to unequal law or unequal policy. That's just not true, but be aware of that. Now, this is in summer of 2020, in a famous tweet, Kamala Harris. Now, this is before the election, just before the election, she tweeted the following. It's not that long, but listen to this. She says, there's a big, and it went viral. This is a big difference between equality and equity. So she said, so if we're all getting the same amount, but you started out back there and I started out over here, we could get the same amount, but you're still going to be that far back behind me. This is kind of a childish formulation. I'm just reading it. It's about giving people the resources and the support they need. Notice that, giving people. So that everyone can be on an equal footing and then compete on an equal footing. She goes on, equitable treatment means we all end up at the same place. Wow. So that's her formulation. Here's more. Equality suggests, oh, everyone should get the same amount. The problem with that is not everybody's starting out from the same place. So here's the way to kind of parse this. What is meant by equality to her? Everyone should get the same amount, meaning outcome. What's the problem occurring to her? Not everybody starts out from the same place. So what then is equity? Everyone starting from the same place. And equitable treatment is we all end up at the same place. Now think of this. One way of thinking of this would be to say that, first of all, this is egalitarianism kind of like synopsized. But it requires two things, which are very odd. It requires that everyone begins and ends at the same place with the same amount. I mean, there could not be a more inhuman account of how humans should spend their lives. So be equal at the beginning, right? That's the idea. Everyone's supposed to start at home plate. You need that. That's the ideal. We need policy to change that as much as possible. And then even as the game begins, we need the ninth inning to end in a complete tie. And presumably at every inning, it's tied all the way. This, to those of you in economics, will sound very much like the pure and perfect competition model, which is anti-competitive. Last thing I want to suggest is, suppose I'm right about this, that the equality before the law principle, the only legitimate one, really, to the extent being eroded by these other two pseudo-concepts of equality is happening. Think of what this means for the culture we see all over the world that seems to be characterized as cronyism. What is cronyism, or the privileged getting their way? Interesting, in Latin, privilege means private law. It means law, you know, unique to some person or group, not general law. So privilege technically is a bad thing legally because it's carving out special favors for special groups or persons. But notice you would get that if you have a system that's trying to assault and take apart equality before the law. The focus and the push would be on differential treatment, discriminatory treatment, favorable treatment, the whole redistributive welfare state, not just in terms of taxing and spending, but in regulating and licensing and zoning and all the other things. And again, not all commercial. A lot of these things, there's lobbying going on for differential treatment on social issues, is really a result of moving away from equality before the law. So it is not a feature of capitalism. I mean, we all know that. We'll argue that the mixed economy invites lobbying, invites people trying to influence the outcome. But the only reason they do is they know there's unequal treatment. They know the stakes are great, that since the Lady Justice is not blind in this system, in this corrupt system, she can be bribed. Or that the government officials looked at from the different direction will be extorting certain favors and certain campaign contributions. And what do they have to dangle in front of people? Differential treatment. Because if they just said to everyone, sorry, we have this law and it's treating everybody the same, no one would give a damn about lobbying a politician. There would be no favors to curry, no favors to pay for. So I'll stop there. My summary point, I think, would be, here are four very distinct, I think, interesting conceptions of equality. but they're not just additive. The subsequent ones are eroding the foundational one, which is equality before the law.
Thank you, Richard. And just want to acknowledge a few people who are in the room and up on stage with me. Scott, who's my co-host here at the Atlas Society for these Clubhouse Chats, our founder, David Kelly, our senior scholar, Jason Hill, Roger, if you didn't catch his conversation with Richard last night, please check it out. Hopefully it's on replay. And I would like to ask all of you a favor. If you could take a moment, go down to the bottom of your screen, hit the share button, and share it either on Clubhouse or on Twitter or Facebook. That would be awesome. So let's get to the questions. And Jason, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. This is very interesting. I wrote a very substantial piece on equality of opportunity. And that, I think, is really the equality of outcome is the logical concomitant of equality of opportunity. So the comment I wanted to make is, what, being a philosopher, of course, I'm going to ask the question, what is an opportunity? Because I think equality of opportunity is probably the most nefarious of all the so-called equalities, because it gives rise to equality of equity. So what is an opportunity? And an opportunity really is a set of circumstances that make it possible to do something and achieve a goal. So equality of opportunity, I think, rests on trying to equalize initial chances of success. But how can you do that without trespassing on the rights of others? So the mother who reads to her children, although she's tired after working three jobs a day, and fosters and engenders a capacity for reading, and her two daughters become executive publishers and become very successful, is going to be the outcome is going to be very different from a mother who thinks that reading to her children is just a waste of time. Are NBA black players who dominate basketball to be penalized because they have more opportunities for playing the sport than Asian men? So it seems to me that opportunities arise as human beings are free to pursue their values and exercise efforts on behalf of their lives. And values result from attributes that persons possess that, as Ayn Rand says, can't be redistributed. So it seems to me what the advocates of equality of opportunity want to do is to deprive persons the result of the consequences of their actions and the attempt to redistribute the products of a person's values indiscriminately is a form of appropriation that is impossible and irrational, because very often I think that these belief in opportunity is magical thinking, because its advocates purport to master the existence of, and I'll end here, phenomena that actually haven't come into existence yet. We bring these things into existence based on our values. And that's what makes it really, really problematic, I think. So, but I really appreciate your comments on that particular vector. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. I agree with you that every time I've, it sounds like you, when you examine equality of opportunity and really push it down, it starts leading to or bleeding into the equality of result approach. And adding on to some of what you said, I think other ways of looking at this is that, well, the first thing I've noticed is people are not going to be against opportunity. And certain societies are known for having more opportunity. In America, for example, more vibrant, entrepreneurial, freer countries generally have more opportunities, call it more choices, more avenues of, how you live your life. Not just that, the early choices of your life, sometimes you can reverse things later. That's not true in many cultures. Change careers, change jobs, things like that, change interests, things like that. So I think one of the appeals of the equality of opportunity approach, one of the reasons people will embrace that, but maybe not equality of result, which sounds clonish and almost science fiction in a dystopian way, is opportunity has a good connotation. It's the equality of opportunity that's the problem. as I suggested, and I won't repeat. I think it's also funny if you remember that line about what is, I forget who coined this, but it's very clever. Someone would say, well, your success in life, you were just lucky, and I'm unlucky. And someone wants to define luck as what? Preparation meets opportunity. You have to be prepared to grasp an opportunity. You know, when there's a knock on the door, you know, make sure you're there to answer it, type of thing. But also the idea of, are you active or passive in your attitude toward opportunity? If you look at it passively as, opportunities are things given to me, and I just haven't been given enough opportunities. Woe is me. You know, versus the person who says, I'm going to make opportunities for myself. Well, now, what would that mean? I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to explore. I'm going to be intellectually curious. I'm going to be out and about in the world. I'd venture to say even David Kelly's point about being benevolent versus being malevolent. The benevolent person on every level is looking for values. I mean, he might be disappointed. He might find bad people and bad detours and back alleys. But the point is, he's expecting the best in others and in other conditions and circumstances. That person is likely to find more opportunities. But he's like a gold miner. He's mining for them. He's actively mining for them. And lo and behold, look, he finds more of them, and he turns out to be a success. So I think if we also move beyond this idea of the active versus passive, it can be helpful. Thanks, Jason.
All right. And I just want to let people know I pinned to the top here a link to Richard's monthly seminar that he holds for students. So if you are a college student or a recent graduate, young professional, please come in and join us on that. We also make it available if you just want to come in and audit, you can do that, but just do so with your camera off, as it's really an environment that we're cultivating for young people. So, Scott or David, did you want to jump in?
I would like to just make a point going back to what Richard said about the equality of law. I mean, I agree with everything you said. However, I think there's a certain danger in sidestepping the justice of the law, as you mentioned in connection with slavery, because in a formal technical sense, a lot of people who advocate or defend government programs that embody equality of opportunity goals, equality of result goals, say we can still formulate the laws in a way that anyone who meets a certain condition gets this kind of treatment. Even take the progressive income tax.
Yeah.
You know, anyone who makes X amount of money pays Y percent of that to the government. It doesn't matter if X and Y are the same. The law makes distinctions of all different kinds between guilty and innocent, et cetera. So I think you have to tie it, for your conclusion to follow, it seems to me you have to tie equality of the law to a concept of the law as based on individual rights.
Yeah.
And that defines the proper scope of law and the sense in which we are equal as equal rights holders. And it's those rights that are then violated by the other forms of equality.
Yes, I like that, David. And I think that's maybe what I was groping toward when I said, oh, by the way, you can't just say, oh, follow the rule of law, or, you know, and assume everyone knows it's going to be a good law. Okay, that's a whole huge good law, just law, meaning what? Protecting individual rights or not? You know, that's not Jim Crow. I agree that. But would you agree with this, David, is the erosion? I think you'd agree there is an erosion of equality before the law. Is it due to the kind of things I'm talking about, or is it in part due to what you're talking about? Namely, no, it's eroding because people don't have a objective conception of what the law is, that it strictly is anything that conforms to and protects individual rights. The concept of individual rights, in other words, being eroded, so will equality before the law. Is that where you're going?
In a way, yes. I mean, the factors you mentioned are totally valid, I think. But I'm just saying that when people, when laws, like the laws that created the regulatory state and the welfare state, were motivated by, in the case of welfare anyway, I think by a big dose of altruism. We hate seeing people suffer, and we don't understand why they're poor in a rich country. So we pass this law, and then it has to, you know, be applied equally. That is, anyone who qualifies in these quote unquote entitlement programs is entitled to that treatment by the state. So I think there's the underlying arguments and values in that drive people toward opportunity and results, equalities, are manifold. I mentioned altruism. I just want to mention quickly one other thing, that there's a line of argument in political philosophy, I know you're aware of this, from opportunity to result, on the grounds that we didn't deserve our native capacities.
Right.
And we didn't deserve the parental treatments we got.
Right.
So Rawls argues that, well, then that's, you know, we're just going to redistribute those unearned benefits that we have.
Right.
And that leads to a level of equality.
Right.
So, and that's based on a determinist view of human nature. Very largely. So that's another underlying factor. But the result is exactly what you described.
Yeah, and I've also on that Rawlsian principle, I've never heard an answer to my retort that, and it really, he really does count on saying nobody deserves anything. He's not just saying, you know, in some cases, and if you're above a certain income, the whole idea of you didn't choose your birth status means everybody didn't choose their birth status, so nobody deserves anything. But the problem is, good, then they don't deserve a handout. They don't. Why would they deserve a redistribution of wealth? You know, so if, in other words, if dessert is out the window, it has to be out the window all the way. The dessert, well, not to be use a pun, you can't have your cake and eat it too, in dessert theory.
Thank you.
He wants that, yeah.
All right.
Thank you, David.
Also wanted to recognize we have the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society in the room, so we're quite grateful to him. We wouldn't be here without him. I'd love to go next to Roger. If you are not following Roger, you probably are, because everybody's following Roger, and you should join his healthy debates. They are spectacular. He's a master, so I try to join all of them because I'm learning from him in the way that he herds everyone and brings out the best in everyone. So, Roger.
Oh my God. Thanks for the nice words. I don't think I deserve that, but it was a fun room last night. And, it's funny, Richard and I didn't even agree on his talk, but, even when we disagree, being able to have that dialogue is really, really important. And I think that anyone that didn't listen to Richard's talk last night, you could see the replay either in my profile or the Healthy Debates Club. You could go check that out. So do that. But Richard, this is the way I think of opportunity. I think of it with the analogy of playing poker. What poker players need is they need to know that the rules of the game are fair for every player, and that the rules don't change just because you're not good at the game or because you have some immutable characteristic. The rules are set, and people can choose to play, and then they sit at the table and they play within that same framework that applies equally to everybody. That would be the equivalent of equality under the law. And then where it gets sloppy is when people start introducing this idea of equality of opportunity. And for some people, they might think that, oh, well, that's they fall into these traps where they'll watch a video where they, I don't know if you guys saw the one where they show that if you have these characteristics, you start here in the line. And if you know, and if you've got this privilege or that privilege, then you're so much further ahead. Well, here's the problem with that. is how do you plan on remediating that? And so when I think of it in the poker analogy, it would be to say that anyone that steps to the table with an immutable characteristic that you deem, you know, is disadvantaged would get more chips to start out with. So the women are going to get more chips to start out with. If you're a person of color, you're going to get more chips to start out with. And we're just going to distribute chips at the start of the game. Like let's say somebody shows up late to the game and there's a chip leader, then it would be quote unquote unfair. And so in order to provide an equal opportunity, we're going to level that new person up to the same chip level that the person that's worked their butt off to get all those chips. We're going to make sure that they're now equal with the amount of chips. And then here's the worst part. When you move into equality of outcomes, at the end of the game, you're going to then say, well, everybody gets their money back and everyone's going to get a fair distribution, an even distribution, not a fair distribution. A fair distribution would be to give it to the person that won the game. But the thing that people don't think about is that as long as we focus on making sure that the rules are fair for everyone and that everyone knows what those rules are, we don't need to provide equality of opportunity or equality of outcomes. Everyone can buy in with the same chip stack. Everyone can cash out based on their ability to play the game. And the reason why some people tend to lean this direction is because they haven't taken the time to learn how to play the game. And I would just say, advice for anyone, whatever that game might be, whether we're talking about the laws that govern society, whether we're talking about playing that poker game, learn what the rules are and then learn how to play the game well within those rules. And then teach the people that you love what the rules of the game are and how to play that game. That's the way that people get better at the game of poker. That's the way people perform better in life. That's it.
Richard, what do you make of that analogy? You just have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. My reaction, thank you for those comments. That's clarifying. I interpret what you said as splitting opportunity into procedural and substantive. When you say rules of the game, know the rules of the game, fair rules of the game, to me, that's the procedural aspect of opportunity, and I think it shades into equality before the law. The substantive part, though, would be the person who says, listen, I know the rules of the game, say, of baseball. I know them inside out. I'm a fan. I'm fanatical about them. I know them better than maybe the players. But I'm never going to be the star pitcher for the Red Sox. I don't have an opportunity. See what they would say? So procedurally, I get it. I've studied. But I don't have the opportunity. Why? Because I'm not a good baseball player. And literally, the serious ones on the substantive side think that's a problem, think that policy should be doing something about that. By the way, I can think of two policies which have been absolutely disastrous that put this into effect. And Roger alluded to this. There are all sorts of studies that look backwards and say, why are people successful? And one of them might be they went to college or they own a home. And those are two policies where what did the government do? The government said, good, let's subsidize people going to college. Now there's so much student debt, now free tuition. Or what did Clinton and Bush do prior to the 2008 crisis? Everyone should own a home. After all, studies show that home ownership leads to, you know, more wealth than if you're renting. And so let's have a policy of artificially promoting home ownership to people who can't afford homes. I mean, these are two policies that have been absolutely disastrous, but they're driven by this opportunity, equality of opportunity approach. I could name dozens of others, but those are just two examples. And I'm just talking about the economic impracticality of those two, let alone the injustice of it. But the main problem is the injustice of it. But they also lead to, you know, gargantuan policy mistakes that wreck whole economies. And sometimes people's whole futures with these debts. It's not quite on the point, Roger, but I wanted to throw out to people that you might notice, and students notice this when I teach them this, I ask them at the end of the day, which kind of ideology or politics would go with the equality before the law? They almost invariably say libertarians. And when I ask them what kind of politics they think goes with equality of result, they almost invariably say, without me prompting them, socialism. And then when I asked them about equality of opportunity, which seems to be a halfway house between the two, they're not quite sure, but some of them will say what I think is true, which is conservatives. Conservatives are very inclined to say, because they don't want to strictly say equality before the law, that sounds too heartless to them, but they're not socialists either. So the conservatives, you'll find, will be very comfortable with saying, I want equality of opportunity. I'm just asking for equality of opportunity. I think George Bush actually had a tagline. This is the opportunity society. In his case, he wanted everyone to own a home.
All right. I am going to, speaking of Richard's students, again, I have a link up. I'm going to be removing it shortly. It is a student seminar. So if you are a student or a recent graduate, or you have a son or a daughter or a nephew that might enjoy Richard's seminar on the intersection between morality and markets, please share that link with them. I'm going to be putting up next the link to Richard's most recent book. So get it now. JP.
I was just going to share a takeaway that I got from today's session from Richard when he read the tweet. And I really hadn't reflected before. I'm not a native English speaker, so I don't. I thought when the Biden administration was talking equity, I just figured it was woke-ish of some sort. But when you put it when you explained it and articulated it that way, I understood that it went beyond opportunity of outcome, and it goes. But then the parallel just jumped into my consciousness of basically just good old Marxist, to all according to need, and from all according to ability. So is it just playing on a reboot of Marxist theory or doctrine?
Well, that's a really good question, because that socialist distributive principle, and it was specifically that the common pot in the socialist community would be filled from each according to his ability, the producers, in other words, but it would be distributed out according to people's needs, meaning it severs the connection between effort and reward, between productivity and the wage you get. And the capitalist principle of income is quite opposite. It's the idea that you get paid in the market what you contribute to production. So that's called the marginal productivity theory of wages. And it's a more just system. There's a correspondence between what you produce and what you get paid by the employer. And there is a certain equality there, JP, right? That the equality is between what you produce and what you get paid. But of course, different employees in the company will be of varying productivities. The Marxist principle tries to say everyone's going to get paid the same regardless of what they produce. And of course, Ayn Rand in her book and elsewhere, the critique of that is it's impossible, it's unjust, and it ruins the company. The 20th Century Motor Company adopts that principle specifically. And now in implication, of course, is if this is done economy-wide, the whole economy will collapse. People start inflating their needs to get paid more and diminishing or hiding their abilities. Well, that is the essence of what the Soviet Union was and any socialist regime is. So the concept, if I were to apply the concepts of equality I'm talking about, there is an equality in the Marxist sense of equality of result, and notice it's ruinous. But there is also an equality of a kind in the capitalist distribution principle, but it's between effort and reward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
JP, did that answer it for you?
Yes, absolutely. It convalidates everything that I had previously inferred. Yeah, I think it's right on.
All right. And we'll see if we can get to two more questions. I'm not sure we will. So, Alex, I'm going to bring you up here, but apologies in advance if we're not able to cover it. We've got so many Clubhouse sessions planned here at the Atlas Society. If you don't get your question answered today, I'm sure we can cover it in a future session. Clark.
Yes, Richard. Thank you so much for your excellent presentation. My question is, can equality under the law survive critical race theory? And let me just give a little bit of context to that. I mean, I consider someone like Bill Gates to be a woke person. At some level, Bill Gates accepts Obama's old line, you know, you didn't build that. I mean, at some level, even Bill Gates, you know, this brilliant entrepreneur that worked his butt off for many years to build his company, thinks that, you know, he's a white guy who got lucky. And so I guess what I'm getting at is, for Bill Gates, if you just asked him, hey, you know, do you believe in equality under the law? He would say, yes, of course I do. But I think his moral goals is to right historical wrongs, you know, to level the racial playing field. And that trumps, you know, his you know, basic view of equality under the law. So he doesn't mind if Lady Justice's blindfold is removed, if he gets his overriding goal. And that, of course, is, you know, again, to level the racial playing field. So I mean, can these concepts, which we all hold dear, equality under the law, can that, you know, survive this incredibly strong CRT and critical theory in general?
Richard, sorry, I muted you there because we got some background noise.
That's okay.
There you go.
My answer, thank you, Clark. It's a good question. My answer is no. There, it cannot survive CRT, the extent CRT is strong. Reminding people, CRT isn't simply saying equality of the law would be nice, but it hasn't really been practiced by this country. They need to reform. CRT specifically says that the institutional, these are the words they use, structural, systemic, genetic structure of the entire legal system is wrong, is racist, is sexist, is patriarchal. So there's no reformist aspect of this. The whole system, because it's systematically corrupted, has to be thrown out. And of course, it evolves mostly from the Marxist argument. So instead of the idea that the capitalist labor relationship is destructive and needs to be thrown out, here the idea is the entire legal system has to be overthrown for a fill in the blank. But no, their view would be any rich, powerful, in this case, say masculine or white, as long as they're the rich and the powerful, they will manipulate and twist the legal system into ways that benefit them and them only. So you could say that they're yearning for equality for the law and against privilege and cronyism, but they don't think it's achievable. Again, from this idea that it's structurally flawed, it would be too nice a word, structurally corrupt and disgusting and worth overthrowing. Good. That's a good question, Clark. CRT, which is absolutely against equality before the law, even being possible as an ideal goal.
All right. And as predicted, we have run out of time. I put a link up there to the upcoming Clubhouse events and other webinar interviews and our book club, etc. If you go to the events section right there at the link, you will be able to pick and choose, or even better, just go to our website and click on the Get Signups, Get Updates, and you will get emailed to you notices of our various upcoming events. So thanks, everyone, and I will look forward to seeing you. I think we're going to be back Tuesday, so I'll see you then.
Thank you all. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, everyone.